I am Planta on the Line at thecommentary.ca. Heather Pringle is an author and journalist and contributing editor to Discover magazine. She's just written a fascinating new book called The Master Plan, Himmler, Scholars, and the Holocaust. It is published by Viking and retails for $35 Canadian. It is about Heinrich Himmler and his sinister plan to rewrite prehistory to fit the Nazis' deadly political agenda. Please welcome to thecommentary.ca Heather Pringle. Good morning, Ms. Pringle.
Hi.
There have been so many books about the Nazi era, Hitler, Himmler, the Holocaust. Why this book now?
Well, I think this book actually covers territory that has not really been explored previously. It takes a look at a previously unknown research institute called the Onnenerbe, which was an SS institute founded by Heinrich Himmler in 1935. Its goal was, on paper anyway, to gather evidence about Germany's ancestors. But its real secret mission was to really manufacture evidence to support the contentions of Adolf Hitler that Germany's ancestors had been a master race throughout all time.
Why haven't scholars touched this before, either German or from around the world?
Well, there's a couple of different reasons for it. One reason for this is the fact that many of the researchers who had been involved in the Onnenerbe actually went on after the war to resume their academic positions, and they became very powerful. Some of them became extremely powerful in German academic life, and they strongly discouraged anyone from taking too much of an interest in the Onnenerbe. In fact, some of the scholars threatened lawsuits towards those who became a little too interested in the subject.
Were these people opportunists, or were they just following orders? What was their story afterwards, after the war?
Well, several of them maintained after the war that they had, some of them said they had only been following orders. Others said that really their work for the Onnenerbe had just been pure scientific research. It had not been, tainted by politics. Some of them just denied completely any involvement in any wrongdoing whatsoever. So their excuses varied considerably, and some of them, because they had been prominent academics before the war, they were able to return to universities in Germany and resume their academic careers.
Now, they say it was pure scientific research. Was that the mandate, the work that the Onnenerbe did?
Well, no.
Yeah, of course not. They manipulated science and they rewrote history.
Absolutely.
How did they go about that to make it believable, I guess, not only to themselves but to other people?
Well, it would, again, the methods really varied. The favorite method was really to act like scientific magpies. They often took little bits and pieces from a variety of sources and strung them together to try to create a convincing picture. Sometimes, in the case of some of the archaeologists, when they went out on excavations, what they would do is they would look only for particular types of evidence, and if they found anything that sort of contradicted the assertions that they were making about those sites, sometimes they actually stopped the digs in mid-process. So they had quite a range of methods that they used to try to support these the racial ideas that they were trying to prove.
Had anyone bought their argument? Had anybody believed them? Were they successful?
Well, I think
I guess history has taught us no. But at the time, did people think that these people had any credibility?
Well, I think that they certainly did have an impact. In other words, because they had impressive titles, because they had PhDs, because some of them were, for example, one of the individuals, Walter Wüst, who was the basically the president of the Onnenerbe, He was actually the dean of the University of Munich. So these were individuals with very impressive credentials, and when they started twisting the evidence and distorting the evidence, they did it sometimes in such a clever way that it became convincing to ordinary people who really didn't realize what was going on.
Now, Arian, would you go into the meaning of that word and the concept that Hitler had in terms of creating this master race or explaining it to people?
Yes. Hitler had the idea that there were three categories of people: the founders of culture, the bearers of culture, and the destroyers of culture. And to his mind, the Aryans were an example of, well, the Aryans were the founders of culture. In other words, they were the ones who had invented everything of value in civilization. They had invented written language. They had invented agriculture. In other words, anything that was at all important had been invented by the Aryans. And it was a central doctrine of the Nazi Party. Now, the whole idea of an Aryan race was a totally fictional idea, and it had a kind of a curious background to it. I'll try to be brief because it's a rather complicated story. But essentially, scholars in the 18th century had noticed resemblances between disparate languages, so everything from Latin and Greek to Sanskrit, and they'd noticed these strong resemblances. And at the very beginning of the 19th century, a German scholar by the name of Friedrich Schlegel said that he believed that everything of value came from India. And so when he saw this all these resemblances between languages both in Europe and in Asia, he concocted this anthropological fable, which basically said that there had once been this race of incredible warriors who had lived in the Himalayan valleys and who had migrated towards the west, as far west as northern Europe. And he called this anthropological group the Aryans. And so it was a totally made-up name. It was a totally made-up story. And it was just something that somehow captured, touched a chord in Germany and captured people's attention. And the nationalists in Germany finally took that story and gave it one last twist. They said that, in fact, the Aryans had these great conquerors had, in fact, been blonde-haired, blue-eyed, and far from originating in India, they had originated in northern Europe. And that final twist turned the idea of Aryan into something very, very dangerous indeed.
But Himmler and Hitler were not blue-eyed and blonde, were they?
No, they weren't. And there's a really kind of almost amusing story, if it wasn't so kind of terrible, really. But there had been a cocktail party that Himmler had attended, and a wife of one of the SS officers came up to Himmler and said, "Herr Himmler, if we believe that, in your racial theories, then we would, how do you explain the fact that you do not look at all Aryan? You don't look Aryan. Neither does Hitler, or Goebbels, or any of the other Nazi leaders." And Hitler just turned to her and said, "Well, I may not look Aryan, but in fact I have an Aryan brain." And so that was his way of getting around this uncomfortable truth that none of the Nazi leadership looked the least bit Aryan.
I'm speaking with Heather Pringle, the author of The Master Plan, Himmler's Scholars and the Holocaust, $35, published by Viking. The concept of race and gender roles and all sorts of other things, those are mainly constructs, are they not?
Yes,
and
they are.
So was this, I don't know how to explain this, was this, how to ask this question, I guess the Ananerba, the Nazis, they were trying to construct myths, and they were trying to prop up these myths to make them believable, I guess, to the public and to justify their regime.
Yes.
I guess the war certainly ended that, they're losing the war. But some of the other things that they did in terms of propagating these myths included foreign excursions, did they not?
Yes, they certainly
and,
did.
And that's a very interesting part of your book. You talk about some of the trips that they make. Where did they go and what did they find out?
Well, they planned 12 major research expeditions, and these expeditions on paper ranged everywhere from Tibet to Bolivia to Iraq to Libya. Now, in fact, they carried out 8 of these expeditions. They did, in fact, send a team of SS researchers to Tibet. They also sent a team of researchers to Norway, Sweden, Libya, and so on. So they in fact, did carry out quite a number of these expeditions. In all of the cases, these expeditions were really looking for evidence of a master race. And they were looking for evidence of a master race that had swept, you know, vast distances and had conquered remote peoples around the world. And, of course, this, again, went to trying to justify and trying to prove Hitler's contention that there had once been this superior race. So the expeditions were really propaganda missions. Several of them were propaganda missions, and in fact, films of the expeditions were shown on newsreels and made it onto the pages of German newspapers. So these expeditions were in fact very, very important to Himmler and his cause.
You met Bruno Beger.
Yes.
It's a chilling chapter where you write about meeting him. Is he still alive?
Yes, he is still alive. Yes, he is.
And who was he, and how long ago did you meet him?
Well, Bruno Beger is an SS officer who was an SS officer, I should say, rather, who was a specialist on racial matters in Nazi Germany. I met him in 2002, and he was 90 years old at the time, and it was a very, very difficult meeting. He had been an important member of the Tibet expedition, and he had carried out racial studies for the Annanarivo.
Was he remorseful in any way?
It sure didn't seem like it to me, I have to say. He produced a book from his library. In other words, he opened up a shelf opened up the cupboard, which contained library books, and pulled out one of the leading racial textbooks of the Nazi era, which had been written by his one of his professors. And during the course of the conversation, he made references to various aspects of his conversation. Just seemed as if it seemed to me to indicate that he had really not revised his opinion about racial matters.
What kind of questions did you ask him, and did he have good recall at 90?
He was very hale and hearty. He was in exceptional physical and mental condition, I would say. I asked him whether he, you know, what his views were of what the Nazis had called the Jewish race, and he immediately told me that he thought, and this again harks back to exactly what the Nazi ideas at the time were, that the Jewish people were a mongrel race consisting of you know, the Hither Asiatic races and so on. Anyway, it was precisely the line that Nazi researchers had taken in the 1930s. So his views on that had not changed one iota.
I guess in looking back at all of your research and the writing of this book, have you come up with any way to explain why these men did what they did and why they were so evil?
Well, it is a very difficult question, and I really struggled with that enormously. And I think that I'm sure that you know, a lot of some of their actions can be attributed to ambition, moral weakness, and so on. But it is exceedingly difficult to try to understand the mindset of people who kind of crossed what I think of as such a profound moral chasm. I think it's almost impossible for us today to try to really enter the minds of these people, primarily because we simply do not hold to any of the views that really motivated so many of these individuals. It is exceedingly difficult to understand these people, I found.
I asked you if you had an explanation as to why these men did what they did. Talk to me about the role that the women in their lives played. Was it significant?
I think that I think it was probably not terribly significant in many ways, and there is one exception to that which I'd like to come back to in a minute. But the Nazi government really believed that women were little more than baby factories. In other words, women were really existed in the marriage to produce children and to look pretty, and that was really the sum total of it. I think that the women were not terribly involved in the politics of the time. Most women were not terribly involved in the politics of the time, and I think that they really played a very, very secondary role, if that at all, in much of this. Although, I mean, it's very true that women many women were quite enamored with Hitler. But in terms of the Anna Nerva, women played a very minor role. And I mentioned that there's one real exception, and that is the case of Erika Trautmann, who I found really quite a fascinating individual. She was an artist and a photographer, and she accompanied Franz Altheim. The two of them went to Iraq as researchers for the Anna Nerva, and while they were in Iraq, they conducted intelligence operations. They gathered intelligence for the SS security service. So she was a really fascinating woman, and she did play a pretty important role, I would say, in the Anna Nerva.
I want to ask also about the critical reaction to the book thus far. How has that been? You spent a lot of time writing this book, I guess, a number of years. How has it been received?
I think the book has been received very well. The reviews have been, on the whole, exceedingly positive. I've been really delighted by it, actually.
And what are you working on now, may I ask?
Well, I do have in mind another history book, another modern history book, but I'm still at a very preliminary stage in it, and I'm a bit reluctant to talk about it at the moment.
Well, Heather Pringle, thanks so much for joining us, and continued good luck with this book.
Thank you very much.
I don't usually read books about Nazis or anything of that sort, but I did read this, and I did find it fascinating, and it was hard to put down and hard not to take some of those thoughts out of your head after reading the book. The book is called The Master Plan, Himmler's Scholars and the Holocaust, published by Viking. Do pick it up.